The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walser, a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth. Book your free call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. That's friendofdinesh.com. Coming up, I'm going to demystify the concept of Christian nationalism, which the left has been using as an insult. Well, all the more reason for us to embrace it. The DOJ confirms it's investigating Trump, but the reasons couldn't be more absurd. I'll review Senator Chuck Grassley's revelations about the FBI. Newt Gingrich joins me. We're going to talk about Biden's America. And I'll talk about the paradox of Kleos in Homer's Iliad. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
The topic of Christian nationalism is back in the news, and it's partly because of Marjorie Taylor Greene, and it's partly because of something that I said. So let's talk about this. Here's Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm being attacked by the godless left because I said I'm a proud Christian nationalist. These evil people are even calling me a Nazi because I proudly love my country and my God. Now, here's Marjorie Taylor Greene doing something that conservatives and Republicans do not often do. The left comes up with a phrase, Christian nationalism, and they start using it as an insult, as a slur. And typically, Republicans run away from the phrase, oh, we're not that. No, no, no. But Marjorie Taylor Greene pulled a fast one on them by basically saying Christian nationalism. I mean, well, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I'm a Christian. I'm a nationalist. So I guess I'm putting the two together. I'm a Christian nationalist. Now, the left, of course, yes, the moment that she used that phrase, started saying she's a Nazi. She's a Nazi. And, of course, the Nazis were not Christian nationalists. In fact, the Nazis were the opposite. They were godless nationalists. And as I've shown in books like The Big Lie, a book that you should read if you don't have it yet, it's available on Amazon, get it. It explores the deep history of fascism and Nazism, and it shows that Nazism is really the sort of ideological ancestry of the left. Now, the left started with a kind of universalism, but it quickly, their socialism quickly became nationalistic. In fact, even in Russia, Stalin's socialism quickly became national socialism. And of course, Castro's socialism was national socialism anchored in Cuba. Maduro and Chavez's socialism is Venezuelan socialism. So these are all national socialists. And so there's a kinship. And as I said, an ancestry, a kind of line of descent from fascism and Nazism. We're talking here about early Nazism, not the Nazism of the Holocaust, and the modern left. But the left is trying to escape, if you will, the fascist and Nazi connection foisted on the right. So they're pretending Hitler was a Christian nationalist. Hitler never called himself that, but he did call himself a national socialist. Now, my tweet in response to all this was, Christian nationalism is good and healthy because Christianity redeems nationalism and gives it a gentler, more humane, and more universal thrust. And then I made the observation that I just made a moment ago. The Nazis represented godless nationalism, which is the foundation of socialist and secular tyrannies everywhere. But let me clarify the first part of what I say here. Why is Christian nationalism good and healthy? Because Christianity, in its core, is not nationalistic. Christ didn't come to save America, and Christ didn't even come to save Israel. Christ came to save humanity, all of us. And the idea of Christian brotherhood transcends nationalism. We're not just brothers and sisters with people who are our fellow Americans. No, on the contrary, there's a kind of community of believers worldwide that does not pay any attention not only to race or to gender, but also to nationality. But my point is that by bringing Christianity, the adjective, and kind of attaching it to nationalism, the noun, we get a nationalism that is not purely nationalistic. We get a nationalism that's moderated by the idea in Christianity that, look, yes, we are here in America. We fight for America. We protect our fellow Americans. We're willing under certain conditions to give our life for our country. But let's remember that this life is not the only life. And let's remember also that there is a world out there and God made us equal. We are moral equals in the eyes of God. That's a universal point. So this is really what I'm getting at. And then here's an article that comes out in Newsweek the next day by Zoe Strakowski. Trump ally defends Christian nationalism as good and healthy. And the article, by the way, not all that hostile, but it does quote Joseph Williams, a professor at Rutgers, saying, quote, Christian nationalists believe the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation, and that this foundation needs to be safeguarded or restored. Now, I've talked about this before on the podcast. I believe that this is true, but in a qualified sense. Obviously, I don't believe that the U.S. was started as a Christian nation in the sense that we would have an established Christian religion. In fact, the Constitution, in its Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, says there'll be no establishment of religion. And I'm good with that. I think that's actually a clause intended to, and that did protect religion. So we're a Christian nation in the sense that Christianity informed the founding. Most of the founders were devout Christians. Even the ones that were not may not have subscribed to all of Christian theology, but they did subscribe to Christian morality. They understood the indispensability of Christian morals to the success of the infant republic. And so I think what's going on here, and it's a tactical move by Marjorie Taylor Greene and by me, the left thinks Christian nationalism is some kind of big insult. We're supposed to run away from the term because they invoke it as a slur. And my point is why? They've never given us a good reason. Now, I watched the show that Rachel Maddow did, at least some of it, where she basically makes a case against Christian nationalism. And she keeps talking about some guy named, I think it was, what was it, honey? L.K. Smith? Some guy no one's ever heard of. So, and she keeps going, L.K. Smith said. And so here's my tweet, which kind of summarizes the Rachel Maddow show. Rachel Maddow's case against Christian nationalism is that there was a guy no one's ever heard of in the 1940s who said he was a Christian nationalist, and it turned out he was also a racist and an anti-Semite. And so, according to Rachel Maddow, no one today can use the term because that makes you just like the guy that no one's ever heard of. QED.
Explain the QED.
QED means the point has now been demonstrated. MyPillow is having their biggest sheet sale of the year. You got to jump on it. The Percale sheets are available in a variety of colors and sizes. They're all on sale. Queen size, for example, regular price $89.98, but now $39.98 with promo code Dinesh. So order now, because when they're gone, they're gone. The Percale sheets are breathable. They have a cool, crisp feel. They come with a 10-year warranty, a 60-day money-back guarantee. So don't miss out on this incredible offer. There's a limited supply, so order now. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. By the way, deep discounts on all the MyPillow products. Call 800-876-0227. That number, 800-876-0227, or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use the promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. We're seeing news reports that Joe Biden's DOJ has opened an investigation into President Trump. Now, my reaction is a big whoop-dee-doo, because this is A, no surprise, B, what is it, the 77th investigation into President Trump? The New York Attorney General has one. Of course, there were ongoing investigations into Trump while he was in office. Impeachment number one, impeachment number two. Of course, the January 6th hearings. And apparently this investigation is in some ways not motivated, but perhaps supported by the January 6th committee hearings. And evidently, the DOJ has been calling people before a grand jury and questioning them, very lengthy hours and hours of questions about various meetings that Trump had. This is going back to December 2020 and early January of 2021. They're like, did Trump talk about overturning the election? Did he have communication with what the media calls fake electors? So these are the sort of alternative slates of electors that would have come forward had the election results been revisited by the state legislatures. But it doesn't make them fake electors. It just means that they were not the official electors, at least until this process had gone forward in the way that Trump intended. In any event, I see from the Washington Post that there are really two types of criminality that the DOJ is supposedly looking at. The first one is potential fraud associated with fake false electors. And I don't really get what the fraud is, because obviously Trump wasn't trying to say, these alternate electors should be treated as real electors and fool the country into believing that they were real electors. There's no fraud involved. There is a, when you challenge a process, you say, well, listen, these would be my electors. And so you let the legal process go forward. And the legal process in Trump's mind in this case was that Mike Pence would send it back to the states. The states would reconsider. They would look at the issues involved. They'd look at the allegations, and then they would put forward the quote, real electors. So, this appears to me to be largely bogus. The very idea that you have electors is supposed to constitute some sort of a fraud. And then, of course, continuing in the Washington Post, the pressure that Trump allegedly put on the Justice Department and others to, quote, falsely claim that the election was rigged and the votes were fraudulently cast. Now, that just, you know, I just chuckle over that one, because while Trump may not have had the evidence for this then, there's a lot of evidence for this that has come out subsequently, CF 2000 Mules. And by the way, lots of people still seeing the movie. If you haven't seen it, this is a movie you must see. There's no way to really talk intelligently about the issues of election integrity. Is our democratic process secure without seeing the film? Whatever you think about it. So you can watch it on Salem Now, salemnow.com, or you can watch it in my locals channel, 2000mules.locals.com. Now, the other charge that they're looking at with regard to Trump, and this strikes me as just prima facie, on the face of it, absurd, seditious conspiracy. And the seditious conspiracy was initially bandied about with regard to all the people who went into the Capitol, as if what? They were going to somehow take over the Capitol and thus take over the country. Even if they did take over the Capitol, that takeover would be more like a kind of Occupy Wall Street takeover of a building. Ultimately, people are obviously evicted from the building, and that's the end of that. So a protest is not the same thing as a seditious conspiracy. By the way, Robert E. Lee didn't want to sort of temporarily occupy the Capitol and walk around with some signs and slogans and then go home. That was a whole different matter when it occurred in the 19th century. So what they're trying to do here is take this charge. And by the way, they've tried to make the charge stick with people like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters, relying, by the way, again, not on anything they did, not on arms that they brought into the Capitol, not on any genuine seditious or takeover attempt, but rather idle chatter. They were big talkers going online saying to each other, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and see, seditious conspiracy. Well, Trump didn't even do any of that. Trump doesn't even have idle talk that they can use to make it seem like he was trying to be some sort of an agent or some kind of a leader of a conspiracy to overthrow the government. Merrick Garland, in a recent interview with Lester Holt, said, we're looking at this, no one is above the law. The usual platitudes and the usual boilerplate. So I don't know where this is going to go. All I can say is that there seems to be little or no merit to the case. Some of us wish we could rewind the clock when it comes to our health. exercising, climbing stairs, all the things young people take for granted, these aren't things that have to stop just because you age. Neither do you have to endure the normal aging aches and pains, because now there's a 100% drug-free solution. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. And the vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more because it works for them. Debbie's excited. She finally gets to do her bar exercise class now that she's alleviated her frozen shoulder thanks to Relief Factor. Debbie's even able to do planks and push-ups, so she's like, wow, I'm never going to be without this again. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa has been writing letters to Merrick Garland and to the FBI director, Christopher Wray. And these letters, normally I'm not big on letter writing because I'm like, a letter is nothing more than a kind of piece of paper that very often these guys are going to just toss into the trash can. Big deal. And sometimes our side has a tendency to think that if you write a letter, you've somehow done something. No, you haven't done anything. But in this case, we have Grassley, who is an influential figure on the in the Senate judiciary. And so it's the committee that has oversight over the FBI. And writing on Judiciary Committee letterhead, Grassley makes 2 points, and both the points have been derived from FBI whistleblowers. So these are FBI agents who have come forward and have apparently revealed 2 interesting things. The first one is that the FBI has been very involved in suppressing investigations connected with Hunter Biden and the Biden crime family. So this is very telling, that the FBI has been deliberately ignoring evidence, and they have been using the fig leaf. In fact, they've been using the pretense that they know to be untrue, that this is Russian disinformation. So the culprit here is a guy named Timothy Tybalt, T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T. He's the FBI agent who has been doing, you may say, the Biden's dirty work for them, covering up the evidence of their corruption, which is actually now in the public sight for all to see. It's all on Hunter Biden's laptop. The Biden family partner, Bob Ulinski, Tony Bob Ulinski, has testified to it. And so what Grassley is saying is, quote, there was a scheme in place among certain FBI officials to undermine derogatory information connected to Hunter Biden by falsely suggesting it was disinformation. And Grassley goes on to say that another guy involved in this is Richard Pilger, identified as the director of the Election Crimes Branch. So think about it. The Hunter Biden story was going to break right before the election. There's an Election Crimes Branch. You would think they'd be all over this. But on the contrary, they were like, let's try to protect Biden in the election. And this Richard Pilger guy, who's supposed to be someone looking for criminality, is in this case looking to suppress public disclosure of criminality. So Grassley concludes that there are, quote, systemic and existential problems within your agencies. And I like that word existential, because I think it should be part of the Republican platform going forward, that we are going to completely bring down the FBI building, by which I mean clean the place out from top to bottom. And this is what the word existential means. The whole existence of the FBI as it's currently configured. I'm not saying we don't need a crime investigation agency. I'm saying we don't need the one we have now. The other thing that Grassley discloses is that the FBI is classifying people as, quote, domestic violent extremists, even when there's insufficient evidence to do this. This is the second thing that the whistleblowers are saying. They're saying, look, the Biden administration has gone out in public and said domestic violent extremism is the most dangerous threat we face. And they look around and they find there's not a whole lot of domestic violent extremism going on, at least not in the places they're looking for. They're looking for it on the right. They're finding very little of it. There is some of it on the left, but they're not looking there. And so where domestic violent extremism doesn't exist, it has to be made up. It has to be concocted. It has to be manufactured. This is in order to back up the Biden claim that this is where the problem is. And so what's going on is that the FBI apparently is sending out instructions to its agents that say basically, look, again, don't be too rigorous about what constitutes domestic violent extremism. If some parent says something like, you know, I'm going to take action, domestic violent extremist. If some protester goes something like, this has got to stop, domestic violent extremist. So in other words, what you do is you, even though there are previously specified criteria, this is what you have to do. You have to meet A, B, C, and D in order to be classified as a domestic violent extremist. The FBI has essentially created its own loosened standard in order to justify its own metrics. It's kind of like, we got to find more domestic violent extremists. Let's classify a bunch of people who don't really meet the standard just because they're engaging in, let's call it, loose talk, a lot of bluster. So this way we can demonstrate there have been no less than 477 incidents of domestic violent extremism, including some guy, you know, basically making swears and slurs in a rocking chair, going back and forth in his trailer in West Virginia. Domestic violent extremism on the rise. Look at this guy. No, he doesn't have any money. He doesn't have any teeth. He's not going to go anywhere. He's not going to blow anything up. But nevertheless, the FBI needs them. Why? Because they need to justify essentially the nonsense and the exaggerations that they've been putting forward before the American people. Right now, court packing is a real danger to our democracy. Make no mistake, court packing is a coup. And the usual suspects, Biden, Pelosi, Schumer, they're working overtime on radical plans to pack the Supreme Court. Look, if we don't stop them from installing four more justices so they can rig the system in their favor, it's going to be catastrophic for our court, our country, our way of life. First Liberty doesn't want to let that happen, not on our watch. So that's why we need you to join us. We're gathering a coalition of a million patriots to say no to court packing, no to the liberal agenda, no to the Supreme Court coup. Franklin Graham, former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese, Dr. James Dobson, the Family Policy Alliance, the Heritage Foundation, and over 400,000 people like you are already on board. So please sign your name now. Go to Supreme Coup, that's C-O-U-P. Go to supremecoup.com to sign First Liberty's letter. That's supremecoup.com. And God bless America. Guys, I'm really happy to welcome to the podcast Newt Gingrich, a man who needs no introduction, but he is the chairman of Gingrich 360, a multimedia production company, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, and architect of the, well, legendary Contract with America, 1994. Newt is also a Fox News contributor, podcast host, Newt's World, and syndicated columnist, and his latest book, which we're going to be talking about, Defeating Big Government Socialism, Saving America's Future. Newt, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you. You've been the architect of some of the pivotal strategies that have been deployed by the Republicans over the last few decades. I'd like your assessment of where we are as a country today, because it seems like we're living in a different America than the one we lived in, let's just say, in the post-Reagan era, even in the Clinton era, and that things have become more decayed, more debilitated, more divided than ever. Do you agree with that assessment, or do you have maybe a more a different take?
Well, I think that the easiest analogy is that we've had a cancer of anti-American left-wingism, which first really began to show up in the early 1960s with the work of people like Marcuse at Berkeley, the student free speech movement of Berkeley, the Weathermen, the Black Panthers, who openly said that they were out to assassinate police and actually killed 13 policemen. The fact that there were something like 180 cities burning in the late 1960s. There were 2,500 bombings in 1970-71. There was a lot of stuff out there. And then the country sort of reacted to it. And Nixon's silent majority turned out to be real. But it was captured for me in two of Theodore White's amazing books on the making of the president. In the 1968 Making of the President, he has a chapter on the news media, which you could write today. I mean, he says, here's the role of the New York Times, here's the role of the Washington Post, here's how far to the left they are, et cetera. I mean, so it was already locked in 68. And in 72, he wrote a sentence which I thought was amazingly prescient. He said the problem McGovern had and the reason he couldn't cut a deal was that in the left, that liberal ideology had become a liberal theology and therefore had a religious connotation and could not be negotiated. Now, this is 1972. And what happens is Reagan comes along. I mean, the Great Society fails. We have inflation. We have a recession. Nixon wins. The country sort of recenters itself. And then we have Watergate, and you end up with Jimmy Carter winning, but really winning deceptively, much like Obama, as a centrist, you know, and campaigning just a guy who carries his own suitcase, which, by the way, turned out to be empty and was a prop. I was sort of told you about the underlying dishonesty. But I would point out that if you read Tom Wolfe's great essays, for example, Mau Mauing the Flatcatcher and Radical Chic, these are all being written about the insanity of the left in the 70s. Now, what happens is Reagan comes along. Reagan codifies and makes really attractive the classic American model of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the rule of law, American exceptionalism. And so we really sort of rewrite ourselves, if you will. And then I think the breakpoint comes when George W. Bush can't cope with the complexities. The system starts to break down at every level. Katrina in New Orleans is handled so badly. The financial crisis is handled badly. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are handled badly. And the country turns to this nice, pleasant, seemingly shallow person who's actually probably the most radical president ever elected, in Barack Obama. And Obama begins to bring in all these people who really represent the metastasization of the left, this growing cancer that's in, it's in the bureaucracy, it's in the colleges, it is in the news media. And of course, you'd experience some of this as a student way back when. So this stuff's all been growing. It's been getting bigger, more powerful, and more radical all through this period. And I think part of what happened, this is just a theory, is that Trump, by the sheer audacity of his assault, aroused such a level of fear and such emotion on the left that they, in a sense, came out of the woodwork. And all of a sudden you get this remarkable gathering of people in which they collectively, as long as they are anti-normal, they are allied with everybody else who's anti-normal, whether it's over sex or it's over religion or it's over, you know, socialism, or you name it, or race. So every strange group in America forms this huge coalition of the anti-normal, if you will. And part of what then happens is they win, again, a little bit like Obama pretended to be normal. Jimmy Carter had pretended to be just sort of a good old boy. You know, they keep Biden locked up in the basement. And basically, if you go back and watch his campaign stuff, it's all centrist. It's not, he doesn't run and say, this is how really radical we're going to be. But he appoints everybody who is. And as they replace Trump and the Trump appointees, the country lurches to a radicalism that within a year has the country in rebellion, which it is. I mean, the country right now, you have probably, well, we have a project called the American Majority Project, which actually you can see at AmericanMajorityProject.com. And we've been doing a huge amount of polling, trying to find issues where there are massive majorities. I'll just give you two quick ones and then I'll shut up. But I want to give you this flavor of where we got to. We asked people, do you think we need to restore the America that works? 87% said yes, which means 87% of the country understands it ain't working. And not just government, but just across the board, things aren't working very well. We also asked people, do you agree with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. that it is the content of your character, not the color of your skin? That is a 91-6 position. That means that the people who really want anti-white racism are an amazingly small percentage, but they're very militant, and they're part of this alliance of the anti-normals. So that's where we are today. And I wrote Defeating Big Government Socialism because we discovered in our polling effort that if you pit free market capitalism against big government socialism, free market capitalism right now wins 59-16 before you even make the argument.
That's amazing.
And so I think we can build a big majority in favor of a normal America.
Newt, let's take a pause. When we come back, I want to explore whether not just the country can be unified around these issues, but whether there's a way to unify the Republican Party. So we'll be right back. It's pretty colorful, you've noticed, at the grocery store and the produce section, all those vibrant colors of fruits and veggies. Our friend Dr. Douglas Howard at Balance of Nature explains that all those colors you see represent nutritional variety. Now, I don't eat anywhere near the 10 daily servings of fruits and veggies, but Balance of Nature, that's the way I ensure I give my body what it needs to stay healthy. Debbie and I take these, the 6 little fruits and veggie capsules every day. Each daily dose is made up of a blend of 31 different fruits and veggies. Wow, 31. Variety equals vitality. Give your body everything it needs with Balance of Nature. Invest in your health. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for years to come. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code America. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751. Or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America. I'm back with Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, author of the primary author of The Contract with America, now author of a new book, Defeating Big Government Socialism. Newt, let me ask you about the Republican Party, because in going back to Reagan in the 80s or even in the 90s when you did The Contract with America, the Republican Party was, you could call it one thing. That's not to say there weren't nuances or there weren't, some people were free marketeers, others were anti-communists, and still others were social conservatives, but they were under the same banner. It now appears that there's fractures in the Republican Party. Some of it seems to be over Trump. Maybe not all of it is about Trump. Would you give an assessment of how the GOP can unify, not just in opposition to Biden, but unify around a set of issues that can make us an enduring political majority?
Well, look, I think you put your finger on it. When you have big enough goals and people rally to the big enough goals, that covers up a lot of the minor tension and the minor problems. When you don't have big goals, then people start drifting down to focus on whatever their personal issues are. Reagan, of course, had anti-communism, rebuilding American culture, and rebuilding the American economy. Well, in 1980, those were pretty good things. You could get people to rally around all three. We have not had... And I think I should also say, in fairness, Trump's not just a personality. Trump was a genuine insurgency against the old Republican Party. I mean, people forget when Trump announced for president in 2015, 63% of the Republicans disliked their national leadership. In fact, one of the reasons that people kept losing is they'd get up and say, you know, I've served in Washington. And people say, that's what I was afraid of. And Trump's greatest advantage was he'd never been there, which is the opposite of how you normally think of things. So I think that you're in a transition period. And I think that Trump is the, in many ways, the most divisive activist reformer since Andrew Jackson. His personality, his culture, his aggressiveness, his willingness to break out of all of the established conventions. And in a lot of areas, frankly, he was right and they were wrong. I mean, I'd authored, for example, putting the American embassy in Jerusalem and allowing Israel to be it was the only country in the world where we did not allow them to designate their own capital. And so I authored this in 96. We passed it. Clinton would only sign it with a presidential waiver. So every year the president would say, I'm not going to do it. Well, Trump comes in and says, I'm doing it. Well, of course, the State Department went crazy. Because the State Department has always opposed this. And they said, oh, this is going to lead to such huge problems. Well, Trump understood that with the rise of Iran, none of the Arab states cared where the embassy was. What they cared about was that the United States was with them against the Iranian dictatorship. And so he did something that the national establishment thought was terrible. This went on in place after place after place. And that's why I think you see the party to some extent split. It's 50% personality, 50% genuine deep changes in what the issues are.
Whose job is it, Newt, to come forward with this kind of vision that you're talking about? When I think back to Reagan, there was a conservative intellectual movement in the 1970s, a movement that was epitomized by people like Milton Friedman and in some ways Friedrich Hayek, even abroad, the impact of Solzhenitsyn. And so Reagan's agenda kind of came out of that. Now, it took a Reagan to put it forward, but Reagan didn't come up with it. It was there before, and Reagan sort of grabbed it. My question is, with the conservative intellectual movement and the kind of place it is today, which is, in my view, largely brain dead, who is going to generate these ideas to take us forward? In other words, not new principles, but new application of old principles to the current situation.
Yeah, I want to draw a distinction between think tanks and action tanks. Part of what's happened is we went from a very tiny conservative movement in the 1960s and 70s. To a huge industry of self-appointed conservative intellectuals, many of whom sit around and do the kind of things you do as a college professor. You look at, I have on my desk the original 1,093-page Agenda for Leadership produced by Heritage in 1980. They had 250 donors who contributors. They wrote, here's how to remake the entire federal government. They handed it to Reagan after the election. Ed Meese took it to the first cabinet meeting, put it on the table and said to the cabinet, this is our agenda. They hired most of the 250 people and said, you wrote a great chapter, now go do it. So Reagan had an entire system. Probably the place closest to that today is the America First Policy Institute, headed up by Brooke Rollins, which has a huge number of people who've had practical experience. And they're action-oriented, not intellectual. I think Heritage still has a big role. I think Hudson does some very good stuff. And then you have places like Hoover and AEI and you name it, but and Manhattan Institute. But what you will ultimately, if we come together, it will be because in the presidential campaign, there will be a candidate who can synthesize all this. I always tell people, you know, the contract with America in 1994 stood on Reagan's shoulders. Reagan proposes welfare reform in 1965, running for governor. We pass it in 1996. And people forget that, you know, there's a gestation period here of big ideas. Well, I think you're likely to see, starting with Kevin McCarthy and the House Republicans this year, with what they call a commitment to America, you're likely to see a significant idea and action-oriented agenda that actually begins to meet the goals you're talking about. And, of course, you have this huge problem that as the media has gone further to the left, you can't get it covered. So you have to figure out ways to, you know, to use your own systems and your own mechanisms in order to get the message out despite, and you've done this, of course, with several movies now, and you know, I mean, the effort to not legitimize you on the part of the left-wing media is kind of astonishing.
Absolutely. Folks, you got to check out the book. It's Defeating Big Government Socialism, Saving America's Future. One of our most creative and effective thinkers and strategists. Newt Gingrich, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Dinesh, it's always great to be with you.
It's never good when the nation's supposed authority on economic policy completely misses the flashing red lights of impending inflation. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has finally admitted there have been unanticipated and large shocks to the economy that have boosted energy and food prices and supply bottlenecks that affected our economy badly that I didn't at the time fully understand, end quote. You know who understood the real threat of inflation? Well, it's people like me who invested in gold and silver with Birch Gold Group. We're protecting our savings from a highly turbulent economy by diversifying our 401ks or IRAs into gold, physical gold. And it's not too late for you to take action now. Text Dinesh to 989898 and get a free information kit on diversifying and protecting your savings with precious metals. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of satisfied customers, Birch Gold is the place to be. That's where Debbie and I are. So go ahead, text Dinesh to 989898. Get real advice from Birch Gold today. Joe Biden recently issued a statement, and there's a kind of visual interest in the statement, because I was watching Biden and I noticed that in the entire statement as he's making it, his eyes don't move. He doesn't actually blink. Now, I don't know if they have somehow wired his eyes open, or at least wired his eyes temporarily open so that it looks like he doesn't fall asleep during the statement, but he's trying to make a strong statement. And here's what his statement says. You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-cop. You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-democracy. You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-American. And this appears to be something I think someone else has drafted for Biden as a response to the January 6th hearings. You can't be pro-insurrection and all these other good things. Well, now, first of all, one is tempted to respond that what we saw on January 6th was in no way an insurrection. People who go to insurrections carry weapons, and not a single person took weapons into the building. So where's the attempted insurrection? In fact, the only casualties occur on the side of the protesters. So this is quite an insurrection where you lose people on your side and there's no one harmed on the other side. They're the ones with the guns and the truncheons and all the other stuff. But I was also thinking to myself, what's so strange about all of this is that we're a country that's actually founded on an insurrection. What's the American Revolution if not an insurrection? And by the way, that was an armed insurrection against the British. And so let's go back over Biden's statement. You can't be pro-insurrection and pro-cop. I guess what he's saying is you can't be pro-insurrection and pro-law and order. Well, the American founders were pro-insurrection, and they were pro-law and order. So you can't be pro-insurrection and pro-democracy. Wait. The American founders were not only pro-democracy, they invented it. Now, they didn't invent that direct democracy was invented by the ancient Greeks, but representative democracy and the idea of a peaceful transition of power. By the way, that had never happened anywhere in the world before it happened in America for the first time in 1800, shortly following the American founding. And then, of course, most comically of all, you can't be pro-insurrection and pro-American. The American founders weren't pro-American. What were they, pro-British? What were they? They were obviously pro-American, and they were fighting to separate America from the mother country so that Americans could, well, let's put it this way, so that Americans could govern themselves in their own interests. In other words, the American founders were what we would today call America First.
Imagine the lifelong impact of a journey to the Holy Land. Surrounded by like-minded travelers, picture yourself stepping foot in iconic locations right out of Scripture. Join Dr. Sebastian Gorka and Dinesh D'Souza on this life-enriching Israel tour, November 30th through December 9th, 2022. For more information, call 855-565-5519 or visit standwithisraeltour.com.
The whole middle part of the Iliad, the part that then leads to the climax of the return of Achilles to the battlefield. But the middle portion is bloody battle going with the tide shifting back and forth between the Trojans and the Greeks. By and large, the Trojans are getting the better of it. Remember, this is sort of Achilles' prophecy. Achilles stays out of the battle, and the momentum shifts to the Trojans. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of dead bodies on the battlefield. As I mentioned in an earlier segment, there's not a lot of wounded. people do get wounded in the Iliad, but typically they get wounded in such a manner that they either die immediately, or they retreat from the battlefield, their wounds are tended to, and they kind of are right back in the action. I think it's Homer's way of keeping a sharp contrast between life and death. And that's really what I want to talk about today, is the paradox, the mystery that surrounds the idea of kleos. Kleos is glory. This is the motive that drives the Homeric fighter. And it's the drive to be remembered, the drive to be acknowledged, the drive to have people talk about you, but talk about you after you're gone. Kleos, I mentioned before, is the only form of real immortality available to the Homeric warrior. And the paradox of kleos, the paradox of glory, is that you can only obtain it by risking death. You can obtain it by either killing someone else, and in many cases, you end up losing your own life on the battlefield. So your immortality is only made possible by you giving up, if you might say, this life. Now, there's no afterlife, at least no afterlife that resembles the Jewish or Christian or even the Islamic afterlife in the Iliad. In the society depicted by Homer, the only afterlife, by the way, we don't see any afterlife in the Iliad at all. But in the Odyssey, there's a journey to the afterlife, and this is where we get Homer's peek into what that's all about. And in the afterlife, you don't really have a body. Your body is detached from your soul. Your body disintegrates. Your soul, the sort of psuche or psyche, lives on. And it becomes a shadow or a shade. Notice that even in Dante's Divine Comedy, there's a lot of reference to Dante draws on this classical imagery of shades, sort of shadows in Inferno and also in Paradiso. But it's a dark and a dank and a dismal and a kind of unappealing afterlife. At one point, Homer in the Odyssey refers to the souls kind of flitting around like bats. So this is not an afterlife to which anybody would reasonably aspire or look forward to. I can't wait. No. So the afterlife that Homeric warriors seek is the afterlife of reputation. Now, the Iliad has been called a poem of death. And it's not just because there's a lot of death, but it's also because Homer is reflecting upon the meaning of human life. And the meaning of human life, it turns out, is closely connected with death. Human beings are the beings who must and do die. Contrast this, by the way, with gods, who are imperishable. They don't die. Homer's gods are a lot like human beings. They're even though originally their functions come from nature, the river god, the thunder god, the sea god, the war god, and so on. Nevertheless, in Homer's gods, they look like humans. They are larger, they are more beautiful, but they do most, though not all, the things that humans do. They argue, they have emotions, they're angry, they're jealous, they eat, they drink. Now, they don't eat or drink what humans do. They eat nectar, they drink nectar, and they eat ambrosia. But they have sex, they can have children, they can have children with humans. Achilles, for example, is the offspring of a goddess and a mortal man. And so the gods are humans writ large, except for one thing. The gods don't die. And I want to argue that for this reason, kleos in the human sense is unavailable to the gods. Why? Because there's no question of what are people going to say about you when you're gone. The gods are never gone. They live forever. So they don't have to worry about reputation. They are around themselves, and they never cease being around. And I think this is really why the life of the gods is dictated by this immortality. In some ways, some of their conflicts appear to be kind of trivial, kind of paltry, kind of almost petty. And part of the reason is that not a whole lot is at stake. They're not risking their lives. They're not going to die. So ultimately, all they're doing is passing time And most of the time they seem to pass by sitting around, getting involved in human affairs and trying to manipulate them, essentially having nonstop banquets and feasts. But the Homeric warrior, by contrast, is somebody who has to risk death. Remember the scene of Achilles where his mother tells him he has two alternative fates. I think what makes that scene so important and so striking is that Achilles is given a choice between dying gloriously in battle and being remembered, lots of kleos, or living a long life, no kleos. And Achilles, when we last left off, is leaning to living a long life. Now, notice that all Homeric warriors are making the same choice. In a way, they're choosing between, hey, listen, do I want to go home? I'm safe. I can live longer. Or do I fight? But the difference between the Homeric warrior and Achilles is that Achilles is told by his mom that there's a certainty to it. If you stay, you'll have glory and you will die. But if you go home, you will live long. So the fate is in a way determined. That's the thing that makes it striking. By contrast, for the typical Homeric warrior, yeah, you're risking your life, but you might die. But you might not. You might survive. You might be able to make it home. So you might be able to get glory from battle and at the same time preserve your life. So human life in that sense is lived in a realm of uncertainty. Now, the gods know what's going to happen to humans, and sometimes we know as the readers or listeners to the Iliad, but of course the figures in the Iliad themselves don't know. And so this is really the point. The paradox of kleos is that kleos is connected with death. It's a human phenomenon because humans are the ones that die, and you get kleos by risking death, either by dying, but more often by killing, by taking life from someone else. And that's the only way to be imperishable. That's the only way to live on, by putting your life, in a sense, on the line.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.